Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. New NAFTA, at least half a new NAFTA. You still have a Canadian issue, but President Trump announcing yesterday, shortly after we got off the air, that he had inked a deal of sorts with Mexico to revise, extend, upgrade, and rename NAFTA. President Trump from the Oval Office with outgoing President Peña Nieto on the phone.
And we made it much simpler, much better for both countries. Canada will start negotiations shortly. I'll be calling the Prime Minister very soon, and we'll start negotiation. And if they'd like to negotiate fairly, we'll do that. You know, they have tariffs of almost 300% on some of our dairy products, so we can't have that. We're not going to stand for that. I think with Canada, frankly, the easiest thing we can do is to tariff their cars coming in. It's a tremendous amount of money, and it's a very simple negotiation. It could end in one day, and we take in a lot of money the following day. But I think we'll give them a chance to probably have a separate deal. We could have a separate deal, or we could put it into this deal. I like to call this deal the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement. I think it's an elegant name. I think NAFTA has a lot of bad connotations for the United States because it was a ripoff. It was a deal that was a horrible deal for our country. And I think it's got a lot of bad connotations to a lot of people.
So from NAFTA to UMTA.
Yeah,
USMCA. That is elegant.
United States-Mexico Trade Agreement.
UMTA?
UMTA.
Or UMTA.
UMTA.
We could drop the S, but UMTA or UMTA. Yes, it does sort of sing.
United States-Mexico Trade Agreement. But Mexico may not be on board unless Canada's on board, allegedly.
Well,
is that fake news?
Here's what I think has happened. There's pressure and sort of self-imposed pressure on Peña Nieto to get a deal done before he leaves office.
Right.
And now Trump leveraged that to leverage Canada to get a deal done. Since this is a trilateral agreement, he's now got a bilateral agreement with Mexico, Peña Nieto, celebrating it. And that puts pressure on Canada to fold into the provisions, at least generally speaking, that have been agreed upon, as they discussed yesterday. So, just forgetting the substance of the deal for a second, I think there's two discussion topics here. It's one, the game theory strategy employed by the Trump negotiation team, and then there's the actual details here that were advanced by some rather protectionist members of the Trump trade negotiation team, starting with the trade rep Robert Lighthizer, Peter Navarro. You can throw Wilbur Ross in there, and apparently you can throw Jared Kushner in there, too. Kush was involved in this.
I saw Kush sitting quietly in the corner with his little tight suit on and his little tie.
Yeah.
They do come in bigger sizes, right?
He's a fastidious little creature, isn't he? Yeah.
Wow.
Trump saying this is good news for those farmers who've been waiting patiently for good news.
It's an incredible deal. It's an incredible deal for both parties. Most importantly, it's an incredible deal for the workers and for the citizens of both countries. Our farmers are going to be so happy. You know, the farmers have stuck with me. I said we were going to do this. And Mexico's promised to immediately start purchasing as much farm product as they can. They're going to work on that very hard.
Yeah, so some details that have emerged since yesterday's announcement. Wall Street Journal opining on the topic. The deal includes an extension on data protection for biologic drugs from 5 years to 10 years. Genetically modified crops can't be discriminated against, and there are protections for ag producers such as cheese farmers against regulatory abuse, these and other details, writes the Journal now, are helpful modernizations for a pact nearly 25 years old. The U.S. also steps back from its demand for a five-year sunset, which was essentially a backdoor way to dampen cross-border investment. The two parties agree instead to a 16-year pact with a review after 6 years. Some may make investors a little jumpy, but progress. But the Journal also says there are problems here. They think that what Trump telegraphed to Ottawa, which is you signed this deal that Mexico and the U.S. negotiated, or you get a 25% tariff on cars made in Canada.
Right.
They see that as problematic. I see that as leverage.
Well, I see it as leverage, too. But, I mean, back to the auto industry, it does add certainty to the pricing of vehicles that are made in Mexico. So that's good. But, yeah, it does put the pressure on Canadians.
To
get off the pot.
Right. And the other aspect of this with respect to the auto industry is to punish imports, which is really the strategy here. Even though this is a trade deal, this is really an America First trade deal, if you will. Mm-hmm. The deal requires that cars sold in North America have 75% of their content made here, which is up from 62.5% in the previous deal. At least 40% of the content must be made with workers who earn at least $16 an hour, which is a sop to UAW. Yeah, and I think an idea that maybe somehow the protectionists within the Trump administration can woo Democrat votes on this trade deal. With Trump's name on it, I think that's going to be a challenge, but perhaps. So that's an aspect of it as well. The Wall Street Journal suggesting that the auto gambit is part of the Trump-Lighthizer strategy to blow up global supply chain, and that explains in part the new labor provisions that go as far as they do in imposing U.S. Labor laws and wage levels on Mexico. So sort of mixed reviews from the Wall Street Journal on the substance of it. I'm always going to be a skeptic of these big, complicated trade deals because I don't think it takes thousands of pages to say free trade.
It takes one page,
and I'm
maybe two.
And I'm an ideological free trader, because of the evidence. But that's not the president's position. It hasn't been. I'm really anxious to hear how Larry Kudlow characterizes this deal and going forward negotiations with Canada, because again, in terms of strategy, I think this is well executed. In terms of substance, I think it is sort of middled at best. And we'll talk to Jim Urio, CNBC contributor, at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour for more perspective.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, and updating John McCain's funeral arrangements and treatment from the White House. President Trump lowering the flag to half staff. Also,
but it was at full staff yesterday morning. Then in the afternoon, he lowered it.
Correct. And despite our differences on policy and politics, I respect John McCain's service to our country, statement the president added to the previous rather vanilla statement that had been issued.
Yeah, and he ignored questions on John McCain from the media because they were shouting them at him.
Mr. President, any thoughts on John McCain, sir?
Okay, Jim, take it easy.
Everybody who was sitting there pretty with Melania. Mm-hmm. I mean, Melania was sitting there beautifully dressed. Your eyes, you can't stop staring at her. I'm sorry. And people are asking him questions about John McCain, and he just didn't say it. But they were political rivals. He did not like John McCain, and I don't like the fact that those two didn't get along, but it's true. And a caller said, or Diamond and Silk said yesterday, at least he's being true to himself. He's not being phony. I don't think that he has been so moved by the passing of John McCain.
Well, you can be, this is where you can be true to yourself. You don't have to be disingenuous like, say, Obama. But also be gracious. And so, he should have gone to lower the flag. He should have gone with a statement about his service to our country, at least in the military, if he didn't want to comment on his political career, and also restrain comment on his political career, and just sort of rise above in the moment of someone's passing. And, you know, and let people out on the hustings like us, the little people.
Yeah.
We can debate the political legacy of John McCain. Interesting. Did you see who the pallbearers are?
Yeah, I thought that was from The Onion.
No.
Is The Onion still around, by the way?
The Onion is still around.
This is true.
Warren Beatty. Warren Beatty. Good to know he's still alive.
He walked in to a party. Carly Simon wrote that song about Warren Beatty.
You're so vain.
Like he was walking into a
yacht. Oh, my goodness. Oh my God. It's five. It's not even 5:30 yet.
I'm bolting it out. You're so vain.
Is that apocryphal?
You
or
probably
did she
think this
did
song
she actually confirm?
About, yes. You're so vain.
Okay. Again.
I bet you think.
Oh, my gosh.
I got to warm up the pipes.
Holy. I just blew up my headphones.
Anybody else Ooh. That's so vain that's
I mean, Carly Simon is bad enough.
She's a great singer, though.
Not really.
I think so.
No.
All right, so besides cutie patootie Warren Beatty, who else? What other hotties are pallbearers?
Joe Biden.
Oh, that guy. I can't. I don't know where to touch myself first with that guy. Woo!
Gary Hart.
Gary Hart.
Mm-hmm. He knows where to touch you.
Oh. My friend followed his campaign and loved it. They used to do beer slides on the plane, on the Gary Hart plane,
was
when
your,
they
was
would
your
take
friend
off
named,
and when they would land.
Was your friend named Donna Rice?
No. Oh.
What was the name of the boat?
All Night Long.
Mischief. What was it? I can't remember.
Give it to me one more time.
We'll see if the listeners know. Remember the name of the boat Gary Hart was sitting in front of when that famous picture
Shenanigans,
was.
Mischief, something like that. Like that I can't think of it.
Oh, I could Google, but it's fun to let people think about it. All right, what else?
Also,
I mean, who else?
The other beefcake there, since you were asking. FedEx CEO Fred Smith.
Oh, he's a hottie. You know, he's on a calendar, right? The FedEx calendar? Month of June?
Yeah, next to his great quote about the golden rule in business. The main thing is to make the main thing the main thing.
Oh, yeah. That's so, I mean, the brilliance.
No, you can see why he's got such a following of the ladies, those kind of aphorisms. It is, you know, the Hollywood types, and there's some conservatives actually attending, too, like Phil Graham.
Okay.
So you got that going for you. And then, of course, the scuttlebutt right now, his wife, Cindy McCain, possibly being appointed to fulfill the remainder of his term prior to a special election.
Yeah, the special election is going to be in 2020, so it'd be a seat warmer, and she wants it. That's what the word out of Arizona is and out of Sedona, that she is ready to take on that role.
Well, she paid for that seat, so I guess it's about time she got a chance to sit in it. She did.
Well,
she financed his first run for Congress.
Right, that's she right. did.
Yeah.
After he left his first wife. But we'll talk about it. Scorned lover.
We don't have time, but Greg from Schaumburg, I'm going to give you credit. I knew I was close, but he got it. Monkey business.
Oh,
monkey business.
Greg from Schaumburg gets an Amy Jacobson t-shirt as soon as we make one up.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I tell you, the hits just keep on coming. First, Brian Williams.
Yeah.
Now Lanny Davis. I mean, if you can't trust Lanny Davis, then we're truly living in a world without heroes.
You mean Lanny?
Yeah.
Hello.
Are you trying to do Saul Rosenberg or Lanny Davis doing Saul Rosenberg?
I'm trying to do Lanny Davis doing Saul Rosenberg.
Amy Jacobson.
The Jerky Boys.
As Lanny Davis is Saul Rosenberg in the Jerky Boys remix.
I could do the weather that way.
Today it's going to be hot and humid.
Oh boy, I'm going to be schwitzing.
You're going to get some swamp butt.
I'm asking you for help and maybe I could sue for punitive damages that you're giving me.
I'm giving you?
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
What'd I do to you?
Well, punitive damages here.
That's a actual audio of Lanny Davis talking to Michael Cohen. And that was after Lanny Davis found out that Cohen's GoFundMe page has pulled in 160 grand.
What?
With the goal is 500. So, hey, keep the phone lines are open. The internet's working. So, you know, keep that keep the donations coming in for Michael Cohen, that tragedy that befell him, the commission of bank fraud that happened upon him.
He didn't bring this upon himself or anything.
No. No.
That, what a waste of money. Save your cash, people.
Well,
Michael Cohen.
I think about 90% of that is from the Congressional Democratic Caucus.
Oh, okay.
In a new interview with the Washington Post, you mentioned part of this yesterday, but it's been added to Lanny Davis. Nothing, if not meticulous, when it comes to correcting the record as it pertains to his various prevarications. Interview with the Washington Post's Tom Hamburger. Rosalind Helderman. I should have been more clear, including with you, that I could not independently confirm what happened. I regret my error.
Oh.
He's talking about being sourced on the CNN story alleging Trump's knowledge of the infamous Trump Tower meeting with the Russian attorney and Don Jr. and the rest of them. Yeah. So he's
so he had to walk that back, right?
Walk that back in. And he also backed off his claim that Cohen, his client, had information that Trump knew in advance about Russian hacking of the DNC in 2016, saying, "I'm not sure. There's a possibility that it's the case, but I'm not sure."
Oh.
That was after he was in a very braggadocious fashion saying, "Oh, my client has information that Mueller would be interested in," and suggesting that indeed, the strong suggestion that indeed Trump had pre-existing knowledge of the DNC hacking, had knowledge before it occurred. So both of those have now been
debunked.
Right.
Well, but, do you think people, because normally people just read the headline and they don't see the follow-up. So we're following up for everybody.
No question. No question. You know,
pay attention.
He told the Anderson Cooper, "I think the reporting of the..." I think the reporting of the story
don't
got mixed up in the course of a criminal investigation. We were not the source of the story. This is we stuff. Do you got a, you got a mouse in your pocket, Lanny? You.
Him. You.
Yeah.
It sounds better with we. Less culpability. Can you do it in the Jerky Boys voice?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, Anderson. I really did it this time. Okay, then. I'm sorry.
Speaking of hacking.
Yes.
This report out that you remember how part of the concern about Hillary Clinton's private server when she was the chief diplomat of the United States as Secretary of State?
Yes. That responsible for taking care of Americans all over the world. Yes.
Having a private server in a closet in Colorado wasn't the best idea.
Right. And then someone thought she wiped it clean. She's like, "What, Louis, with a cloth?"
Right. Yeah. She's a cut up. The report that China was able to hack into her private email server, Chinese owned company operating in D.C., hacked Hillary's email private server throughout her term as Secretary of State and obtained nearly all of her emails. According to two sources briefed on the matter who told the Daily Caller News Foundation that the Chinese firm obtained Clinton's emails in real time as she sent and received communications and documents through her personal server, probably to, you know, whispering Sid Blumenthal. And the sources are saying the hacking was conducted as part of an intelligence operation. So two things there. Number one, the lack of security and how that jeopardizes people in the field. Number two, that the interference into the operations of the United States government and potentially the how we conduct our elections is not limited to the Russians. Oh, by the way, which I think we all knew, but since the left is so obsessed with the Russians, let's broaden the scope here to understand the full panoply of our enemies and what they're up to.
A panoply, common spelling?
Yeah.
Pan apply.
Yeah.
Okay.
The intelligence inspector general found virtually all Clinton emails were sent to a foreign entity. That's that was Louis Gohmert, the Texas Republican, saying so at a July 12th House committee on the judiciary hearing. He did not reveal the entity's identity, but he said it was unrelated to Russia. So perhaps this is what he was referencing when he made that overture back in July. Worth noting. Continuing in the topic area. Hey, Bruce Orr. I don't know if Nelly is going to be with him. That's his wife.
Nelly? Yeah. Oh, Nelly. No, that's really a bad one.
I do it better, Keith Jackson.
Fine.
Try it again.
Oh, Nelly. No, that's even well. Oh, Nelly.
No.
I miss Keith Jackson.
He's great.
He made me love football.
Great college football announcer.
Yes.
That's Nelly Orr is Bruce Orr's wife. She's the one who worked for Fusion GPS. Bruce Orr is the one who's the number four at Justice, who was acting as a cutout for Christopher Steele, communicating back to the FBI after Steele had been dispatched as a FBI asset.
It's like characters of a mystery novel.
It really is.
Honestly. Or we're reading from a soap opera script. I don't know.
Truly, we should have sound effects for this. I mean, it's, Bruce Orr is going to be on the Hill today to testify behind closed doors.
Oh, boo.
Yeah, I know.
Like, yay!
Yeah, I know.
I don't like those closed door meetings
because
we don't get the dirt.
Yeah, this is on the House side. Interestingly, and Byron New York points this out in Washington Examiner, boy, attendant to Orr behind closed doors before House committee today, the New York Times, trying to run interference for all those who were trying to run interference for Team Clinton and the DNC, that Justice, FBI, CIA. Bruce Orr fought organized crime. Now he's a target of Trump.
Oh.
A glowing review of Bruce Orr's storied career in law enforcement. You could do the same piece about Rudy Giuliani, right? As U.S. attorney, he fought organized crime. Now he's a target of the left. Now he's a target of the D.C. press corps. But I don't think they're going to do that review of Rudy Giuliani to try and prop him up to explain some of his pronouncements, frankly, as representing the Trump legal team. But I just love the timing of this. Orr's on the Hill, and then the New York Times is out with, here's Elliot Ness being unfairly interrogated by a House committee because he's a target of Trump. Mm-hmm. And again, all of these individuals, I don't care their party affiliation. I don't care their credentials. I don't care where they went to law school. What you've done, your conduct, just right. Address Bruce Orr's conduct. And much as Kim Strassel suggested of Peter Strzok, if you were being investigated by Peter Strzok and or somebody like that who had that much antipathy for you, would you feel like you're getting a fair shake?
Oh, heck no. How's his GoFundMe page doing, by the way?
Peter Strzok?
You know what?
That's a good question. Look that up. See if he's beaten Cohen. There's only so much Democrat money to go around. But think about the same thing with Bruce Orr, number four at Justice. If this was occurring with the targeting of Democrats at Justice, or the targeting of you, and Bruce Orr was working with an oppo operative gathering dirt on you and trying to otherwise undermine your position, would you say, hey, but Bruce Orr has a record of fighting a Russian organized crime, so it's all okay? I don't think so.
Just in, Peter Strzok's GoFundMe page, their goal is $500,000.
Uh-huh. Same goal.
Yeah, same goal as Cohen's. Right now he's in the lead. He did have a jump start on Cohen. He's at $460,518.
$460,000 for Strzok and $160,000 for Cohen. Boy. There's, $460,000?
College scholarships they could have offered.
$460,000. So there's $620,000 worth of people mad at their money.
La 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 ka-ching.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We began this discussion yesterday after the Vigano testimony over the weekend. This memo written by former high-ranking official in the Catholic Church about the systemic sexual abuse in the church and the cover-up of it, including now reaching Pope Francis, per the allegations of Vigano, suggesting that Pope Francis ignored what he had to know was true about former D.C. Archbishop and Cardinal McCarrick.
And Pope Francis was asked that on the plane yesterday with reporters, and he refused to answer the question.
He said, you've read the letter. I've seen the letter. You've seen it. You make your own judgment. I will not say a single word on this. And you've heard from some of the leading Catholic intellectuals in the world, including Princeton's Robbie George, suggesting that's just not an acceptable statement in response to the detailed testimony of Vigano. And I agree with Robbie George. Speaking as a Catholic, my experience in the Catholic Church, going to Catholic school from K through 12, was always good. The priests, the nuns, the Benedictines, the monks, the lay people, it was always good. But that clearly wasn't the experience for a lot of people. And this has been precipitated by this grand jury report in Pennsylvania, whereas our friend Selena Zito writes, 54 of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania were home to a priest who is alleged to have sexually abused other individuals. And the church is unbelievable after a certainly north of $1 billion in settlements. And, you know, we're getting into decades of reckoning here. And it continues to be piecemeal and painstaking, now reaching the papacy, where it appears that it's going to continue to be painstaking because Pope Francis will not address it, at least so far, on the merits. And if he doesn't, if he won't, then I think you're going to hear more people calling for him to resign, and I certainly will be part of that chorus.
Well, it was weird because Cardinal Supich, our Chicago Cardinal, he did one-on-one interviews with each local media. And, you know, Chuck Gowdy asked him about, you know, did the Pope cover up any sexual abuses? Did he know about any cover-ups of sexual abuses in the United States?
My experience with the Pope is that as soon as he knows about something, he acts on it.
Yeah. And he danced around the question, danced around, and then said that.
Yeah, well, you should go chapter and verse with Supich on the Vigano letter, because Supich is implicated not as covering up sexual abuse, but as being a favored son of McCarrick. He wasn't supposed to be named the Archbishop of Chicago, and it was, according to Vigano, it was McCarrick and a small group of individuals who were counselors to the Pope who shoehorned Supich into Chicago, as well as another archbishop in Newark. Also mentioned in Vigano's testimony is Cardinal Worrell, who was the Archbishop of Pittsburgh, Seattle, Pittsburgh, and ultimately D.C., who was seen as a whistleblower with respect to the sex abuse scandal, and now it turns out maybe not so much. By the way, also Supich.
He sat down with Lisa Madigan yesterday, was interviewed by her, said that there's no secret files here in Chicago.
Yeah, Lisa Madigan will not get to the bottom of anything. Mm. It's a nice pro forma event. Supich should also be asked and should have to account for his conferring an award to McCarrick just 2 years ago.
I really wish you sat down and interviewed him rather than Chuck Gowdy.
Well, I wish I would, too, but I don't think the Cardinal wants to
have a one-on-one with Dan Prof?
Or the Arch would allow him to do that. For more on this topic, from a very personal level as well, very, very, very good piece in the New York Post by Selena Zito, when the beloved priest from your childhood turns out to be a monster. So she's got a personal experience to recount as well. Selena, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why don't we just start kind of with your personal experience I just referenced and that you detail in your column, particularly since this firestorm, most recent firestorm generated from that Pennsylvania grand jury report from, you know, whence you hail.
Oh, right. So I grew up a Catholic in the Pittsburgh area. In fact, I've known Bishop Worrell for most of my life. He's a native Pittsburgher, and he ascended into the hierarchy of the Catholic Church here in Pittsburgh. I attended a small little, well, at the time, actually, during the 60s and 70s, it was a booming blue-collar, middle-class Catholic parish in the city of Pittsburgh, and attended a Catholic school, elementary school there from first grade and through eighth grade, and was stunned to find out that during my time there were three priests who have been accused in this document, including my favorite, who was Father John Maloney. He was, when I was in first grade, he was 22 years old. He's a young priest. All of the kids looked up to him. He would come out and, you know, play in the playground with us. And when he spoke to, he did Mass every Tuesday with all the children in the parish. And when he left, when I was in, I guess, about sixth grade, I was, you know, really sad. But when I saw him on the list, I was absolutely devastated that someone that I had really looked up to and had, you know, given me my first two sacraments outside of baptism, which is confession and communion, just devastated to find out that he was among the 99 in Pittsburgh who had abused children throughout their career.
Did he abuse anyone that you went to school with or anyone in your class or anyone
in your
church?
No one is named. Yeah, no one is named in the document. So that remains unnamed. And that sort of haunts you because you try to think, gosh, how did I not see someone, you know, hurting? I mean, how did I not see someone who was, you know, obviously hiding a secret? You know, you search your mind's eye to try to imagine, you know, if you're in school or in the playground or in church, was there someone who should have stood out to me? But of course, you know, you're a kid and you don't always have those instincts that you have as an adult to be able to spot problems.
The impact on the church is quantifiable, and you can also kind of pick it up on site if you go to Mass in terms of the dwindling attendance, the dwindling contributions, the financial problems that archdiocesan centers are having. But I wonder, I mean, particularly Pennsylvania with that grand jury report is sort of a whole different thing than just kind of living with the drop of this over the last couple of decades as a Catholic. And I wonder what the fallout has been from that grand jury report over the last couple of weeks.
So I was at Mass the following Sunday, and it was probably half as what it usually is. And it's already dwindling, as you said. Part of the problem, I believe, is that if people have reached this moment, and it's sort of a judgment moment, okay, how are you going to handle this? How are you going to prosecute this? Are you going to show remorse? And we're talking about from leadership within the church. You know, part of the struggle for Catholics is that we are taught as part of our theology that the institution of the church, meaning the bishops and the priests and the cardinals and the pope, are also divine. And so when there's very little remorse and there's very little addressing of the issue and it's brushed aside, in particular handled almost as though it's a politician, right? Bishop Worrell has handled this very politically. The Pope has handled it very politically, but they've not handled it empathetically, sympathetically. There's none of that. There's no deep sorrow. There's no regret. There's no asking for forgiveness. It's very curt and dry and not what we as Catholics expect from our leadership. And while this will affect my faith, What it does impact is my trust in the institution of the church, and that has to be earned back. And I suspect there are many people of the Catholic faith that feel these a similar way.
I mean, their statements were without remorse or contrition. So the question needs to be asked, if Pope Francis knew about the sexual abuses in the United States, covered them up, should he resign? Do you want him to resign? Or do you have to wait for more information to come forward?
Well, if that is the case, if he knew and still allowed it to continue and still allowed these criminals to behave that way with minor children, well, I can't imagine how anyone should be able to keep their position of overseeing people who he would allow to continue to commit crime.
He rehabilitated McCarrick, and it is not credible. And not just from the Vigano letter, just the timeline, the details that were publicly available for a decade before he was elevated to Pope. It is not credible that he didn't know about McCarrick, and he made him an advisor anyway.
And that's, you know, he is another one who is incredibly political in terms of how he manages things. And that's one of the problems, and one of the problems the Catholic Church has is as these men, and it is men, it's only men, who rise in these positions, they become distant from their flock, they become creatures of the perfect scene, the perfect words, but they don't become administers of the faith and the behavior that you should have when there's a situation that is just untoward.
And this is how you get contrition and repentance for thee, but not for me. That sort of culture. And I mean, this is within the same topic area. This is not abuse, but it is unseemly. The story out of San Jose. The San Jose diocese buying a $2.3 million retirement home for their local bishop, Patrick McGrath, a diocese of about 640,000 Catholics there. Now, obviously, that's a ritzy real estate market, but yeah. Still.
$2.3 million?
Does the bishop need
a family of 12?
Does the bishop need a five-bedroom mansion for his golden years? It's that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously the sex abuse stuff is on a whole nother plane, but it's just this kind of stuff. There's one faith for you, and then there's another way of living for me. It is very much, I think you hit it on the head, it is very much like you're talking about a bunch of politicians, not faith leaders.
Exactly. I mean, I can't even imagine that a $2.1 million
house?
$2.3.
And obviously, he has
kids,
he's a bishop.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that's a lot of space for one person.
Yeah, that's a sense of entitlement that is beyond the pale.
But
with
Cardinal McCarrick, even Pope Benedict confirmed that he disciplined him. For bad behavior.
It's a fact.
It's not a dispute. And then he's an analyst on NBC News. I mean, how do you ever gain trust back in the Catholic Church and how does it affect your religion?
Well, as I said, for me personally, it doesn't impact my faith, but it does deeply impact my relationship with the church. And by church, I mean the institution. And while I can't speak for every Catholic, I suspect that is probably a common sentiment that is held by many people, and this goes to sort of that loss of trust in institutions throughout, every industry. It's not just the church. We have a fracture in our society with institutions by large. And this is just another one. And I don't think that this connection with larger institutions and expertise is very healthy for a society.
Yeah.
You know, but they certainly have earned it.
No question. And I think it's an important distinction that you're getting to. The it's not the flaws of Catholicism, the faith. It's the flaws of the men in the hierarchy of the church. The
exactly.
faith is not impugned by the evil acts of mortals who allegedly right. ascribe to it, even if they wear vestments. And that distinction needs to be made. It's not made in the press very often.
Right. And that's what I wrote in my column this week. It was not a I have not lost my faith. My faith has nothing to do with human, you know, like earthly humans.
Right.
It has everything to do with my belief system. But, you know, these were earthly humans who conducted and looked away and shuttled around people who abused and harmed children in a very heinous way, robbed these people of their childhood. I don't know how you, I'm just stunned every Sunday or, you know, or Friday when statements come out and nothing's better, nothing's addressed. And I think that the church as an institution is going to suffer for this.
Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor, the book, Don't Forget, on Politics, The Great Revolt Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics, and her most recent column, you can get at Town Hall and elsewhere, When the Beloved Priest from Your Childhood Turns Out to Be a Monster. Selena, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, sorry that happened to you. And Selena joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy took some calls in reaction to our conversation with Selena Zito about church sexual abuse now reaching the papacy, and Pope Francis under fire, as he should be, perhaps to resign because he had knowledge and look the other way, particularly with respect to Cardinal McCarrick. Jim in Tampa Bay.
Good morning, guys. Great interview. I was struck when you and Selena were talking about the politics feel of it. I worked in Catholic schools for 25 years. I once asked my principal, glib, smart priest, what's it like in the priesthood? He said, the first thing you've got to know is it's the most coldly political world group of people in the world. It makes the presidential election seem like a student council election.
Hmm. Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I mean, Supich, one of the things that Supich is renowned for within the confines of the church is being very political. And my interactions with Supich, limited as they have been, confirm that
yeah.
he is a very, I mean, he makes pronouncements on all kinds of political and public policy issues, but in addition to that, very political in terms of positioning, he's a political thinker.
Right. Which, he did say yesterday, too, yeah. that this isn't even going on, this going on in CPS. He acknowledged that, and that
yes.
all victims need to be heard. And they have, Dan, they have a new hotline. New sex abuse hotline in Chicago, in case you care.
The Arch has paid out $140 million so far in sex abuse settlements. I mean, some high-profile cases. Daniel McCormick out of St. Agatha. That's $4.5 million just with him. Pete in Montgomery.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Leaving aside the X factor or morality of a priest being a pedophile, one of the things I've always used to defend the Catholic Church, even though I'm Lutheran, is that as a population, or a trade organization, a union, or a profession, the incidence of pedophiles in the Catholic Church can't be higher than the incidence of pedophiles in any other union, trade, organization nationally as well.
Yeah.
Given the articles, I'm starting to wonder if that's a fallacy in thinking.
Thanks for the call,
Pete. Have you heard any statistics otherwise?
Yeah, there's a report by John Jay Law School. Thanks for the call, Pete. George Weigel has written about it. You know, it's less than 5%, mostly contained to the 70s and 80s. However, The small percentage of big numbers, I say in other topics, small percentage of big numbers, a big number and a big problem. And it is in the Catholic Church. And the real problem is what we were talking about with Selena Zito, the lack of a full preemptive reckoning. It has been painstaking. Everything has to be pulled out of the church, mainly by an otherwise hostile press corps. When spiritual leaders starting in Rome should have been on this and rooting it out and being held to account from the outset. And it's been decades, and they still haven't been. And that's a big problem, and it's all self-inflicted.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. See Sheriff David Clark and James O'Keefe at Freedom Summit 2018. Tickets on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You got a new NAFTA, or as the Wall Street Journal says, half a NAFTA.
Oh, I like that. Half a NAFTA. Or USMCA. United States-Mexico Trade Agreement.
Yeah, President Trump likes the sound of that batter because NAFTA has bad connotations to him and his protectionist trade team, as well as a lot of Americans.
And we made it much simpler, much better for both countries. Canada will start negotiations shortly. I'll be calling the Prime Minister very soon. And we'll start negotiation. And if they'd like to negotiate fairly, we'll do that. You know, they have tariffs of almost 300% on some of our dairy products, so we can't have that. We're not going to stand for that. I think with Canada, frankly, the easiest thing we can do is to tariff their cars coming in. It's a tremendous amount of money, and it's a very simple negotiation. It could end in one day, and we take in a lot of money the following day. But I think we'll give them a chance to probably have a separate deal. We could have a separate deal, or we could put it into this deal. I like to call this deal the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement. I think it's an elegant name. I think NAFTA has a lot of bad connotations for the United States because it was a ripoff. It was a deal that was a horrible deal for our country. And I think it's got a lot of bad connotations to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's elegant, Dan.
It really is,
especially the acronym. Yes.
But he said it's a super deal. It's a great deal. Farmers who've been waiting so patiently, their patience will have now been vindicated.
It's an incredible deal. It's an incredible deal for both parties. Most importantly, it's an incredible deal for the workers and for the citizens of both countries. Our farmers are going to be so happy. You know, the farmers have stuck with me. I said we were going to do this. And Mexico's promised to immediately start purchasing as much farm product as they can. They're going to work on that very hard.
So he's done a couple of things. One, he's in process of keeping a promise to renegotiate this deal that he said was such a horrible deal, much as he nixed the Iranian nuclear deal, which was a bad deal. He's right about that one. Mm-hmm. There are some improvements, even the Wall Street Journal has to admit, including extension on data protection for biologic drugs and stepping back from sunsetting cross-border investment and essentially effectively pushing against import of cars. So that's good for the auto industry, sort of a stop to UAW with some wage level requirements for Mexico as well when it comes to the auto industry, which you can look at favorably or unfavorably. So a bit of a mixed bag as far as the journal's concerned, and I would agree, a bit of a mixed bag and the approach. So on the merits, that's one assessment. In terms of the strategy of putting Canada in a box, he's done a good job. They did a good job of that. The Peña Nieto wanted to get a deal done before he leaves and gives way to Obrador in Mexico. And then now you got Mexico and the United States working in unison to put pressure on Canada. And, you know, Canada's taking the shorts, as they always do.
Canada.
anyway. And it is to heart.
Don't tell Ryan Reynolds that.
Yeah, it is difficult to take him seriously with that with third grade part-time drama teacher as their prime minister, I got to tell you. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, who is a CNBC contributor. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So your initial reaction to what the president announced yesterday and the details as we know them?
Well, from a market standpoint, my initial reaction was not exactly correct because the stock market obviously liked it when the talk came out that we were entering an agreement with Mexico. So my thought was, well, what is in this that makes this good for equity markets? And then I realized too late that it's just that we have an agreement in place at all.
Yeah.
The market likes to believe that the Trump's a deal maker, but up till this point with the trade talk, all we've seen is asks. We haven't seen any gives, and we haven't seen any agreements. We have a little bit with Europe, I guess. But the number one thing is that we're agreeing with another country, patting each other on the back and moving along. Number two is the implications for Canada. Obviously, if you want to dig into the nuts and bolts of why this is good, I think we like the fact that that there's wage considerations in there. We always, in our minds, believe that, rightly so, that all of manufacturing was taken away from us because of the plethora of cheap labor in other places, and that's very, very true. I'm not sure that we can fix that at any time, but I think the market likes a tip of the cap toward that.
Well, how does it add certainty to the pricing of vehicles that are built in Mexico?
I don't think it does. I don't think it does. And actually, when I even look at the going up from 62% to 75%, that is somewhat protectionist. To tell you the truth, I had forgotten that existed in the NAFTA thing. I like all these restrictions being taken away and letting us compete on a global level. Now, you joked about his protectionist policies. Up until recently, I always argued that he's not a protectionist at all. He wants free trade. He's just using what appears to be protectionist threats in order to achieve this ultimate goal of removing these barriers. But then I see something like that, and it concerns me a little bit. Not enough to throw me off that opinion, but enough to make me take a little pause.
Yeah, the Journal observed something sort of below the fold that's important. They write that the bilateral deal strips current protections from most U.S. investors in Mexico. Oil and gas, telecom, power gen investors will retain what they have now. Others will be protected only against physical expropriation. And what the Journal is suggesting is that Trump is happy to let Mexico use regulation to favor domestic competitors, because they figure if U.S. companies are more vulnerable to foreign abuse, then their CEOs will be more likely to keep the money at home.
No doubt. But also remember this, too. I think that you guys hit upon this a touch, is that he was willing to make concessions with Mexico because the bigger deal is bringing Canada to the table, putting pressure on them. That's been the one that's more in the focus. And once that's done, we can presumably, as a team, change our focus to China. So for him, this may have been a pretty brilliant negotiating strategy to give concessions to Mexico, sign the deal, shake hands, and then move along.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in terms of game theory, it's very well executed. It's the substance that's, the focus. And what about his sort of telegraphing or, passively, aggressively threatening a 25% tariff on cars made in Canada if Canada's not quick to react and ratify?
Well, this is something that would have shocked us a year ago when he says things like this, right? But we're used to this now. This has been such a strange time in our political life where the things that are said now have become commonplace, where if anything like that was said a year and a half ago before we're used to it, when every politician that we voted for and put in office had very measured things to say. Well, we've thrown that completely out the window. He says things, and I find it interesting. I think that there is definitely some positives to it, letting people know we're really not messing around. Whether he's going to put a 25% tax on Canadian cars tomorrow, I doubt that's really going to happen, but I like the fact that he's saying, listen, we're playing hardball, and we are the big dog here. It's better, more beneficial for you to acquiesce and come to an agreement with us than it is for us to you.
Well, announcement of the U.S. and Mexico tentative trade deal was a great day financially on the stock market. Do you expect some more movement today, or are they going to take a break?
In the last 5 days, I've seen three things that I think were very, very good for the stock market. On Friday, when Jay Powell spoke, he made a comment saying that he doesn't believe that we're at a risk of overheating now. That's exactly what the market wants to hear, because the market doesn't want to think that Jay Powell is going to raise rates too quickly. And so the overarching potential negative is rates going up too quickly. They could do that for one of two reasons. One is that they just make a policy mistake and just tighten too quickly. Two is they feel pushed into it because they see wage pressures and inflation pressures, particularly from the wage side. In absence of that, I think his statement was very, very positive. And yet then you rewind the clock back to Wednesday night when the announcement of the legal troubles came up. If a market is extended and overbought, it can latch on to a small to medium-sized reason to break. For instance, the Cohen and Manafort things. The S&P broke 20 handles. By the next morning, they were already starting to buy it up. That was a sign of underlying strength. Now you throw in this trade thing. I think those are three unambiguously good things in a short amount of time. I think if we can consolidate above the 2,900 level in the stock market, because you think about it, you can say we're stretched. We've rallied a ton over the last couple of weeks. But if you look at it from a seven-month standpoint, we're up about 0.9% in 7 months. We've just taken out the highs. So we can consolidate a little bit, then we move higher.
And just kind of drafting off of that point, what we see at least right now is that another Keynesian fail, right? There is no liquidity trap.
I don't believe there is now, too. But I believe that the bigger thing is that we are pivoting. Okay, I just heard someone else say this morning. It was brilliant, is that we had such a painful, quick drop in the 08 period, not just economically, but in the stock market. And then our recovery was so muted and so soft over the next 8 or 9 years. And now it's all kicked into a higher gear. But that the fact that it was so muted has elongated this middle part of the economic cycle hugely. And it's going to elongate the rally in the stock market as well, is my opinion on that.
And so with respect to new NAFTA or whatever you want to call it, and assuming that there's some deal struck with Canada, so it's bilateral again, trilateral again. Is the market really just wanting something that is maybe a little bit worse or a little bit better than NAFTA, but as long as it's sort of within narrow parameters, it's not really going to, and it's so it doesn't change the landscape dramatically, that's going to be good enough?
Precisely, but remember that the implications are that victories by Donald Trump now may echo in the elections in November. And one of the other things the market's worried about is an influx of candidates who are less corporate-friendly, economic-friendly in November. And a victory now has definite implications for November.
He is Jim Urio, CNBC contributor, also being the Renaissance man that he is. He's a proprietor of Brandt's and Palatine. He's a Chicago guy.
Right.
Thank you very much for plugging Brandt's. Brandt's has a nice outdoor deck. We have about 6 weeks left of nice weather. Come on out and have a burger.
Always be closing. Best burger in Chicago.
Yeah. It's true.
All right.
It's true.
Jim Urio, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and having this conversation with a guy who's a real estate professional, smart guy. We're talking about home prices in Illinois and where this is all going with the highest property taxes in the nation. And
do you think realtors are onto the property taxes, or are they just trying to ignore it when they're selling a home?
Well, you know, probably a bit of both. But I mean, part of it is, you know, the real estate professional is the, you know, forever the optimist, right?
Right, of course.
The market's always hot.
You can't be like, yeah, you know what? You don't want to buy here. Property taxes are too high.
Right.
But then you really can't buy there either. A little bit lower, you get more bang for your buck, better police protection, better schools.
So his essential opinion was things are going to snap back.
Oh!
We've been slow to recover from the depths of the Great Recession as compared to other major urban centers. Yeah. Yes, property tax is an issue, but things are going to snap back because
why? Yeah.
Because we got Chicago, because we got these great schools, and perhaps he's right in small enclaves where people are insulated from terrible public policy, where they're insulated from bottom line sensitivity, like the North Shore. But but that means, just so you know, you're still going to take a hammering on your house. You may not care. Okay, fine. If you don't care if you lose a couple few hundred thousand more, we've talked about houses around the metropolitan area in rich areas of Lake County where people have lost seven figures.
Hey,
if you don't care, well, okay, don't care. But a lot of people do, and this is not like the thing that I was trying to communicate to him. This is not a business cycle issue. This is a structural issue. You cannot escape the math. And people just don't want to confront it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with what you're saying, but I'm just not going to act on it. I can't disagree with what you're saying, but I just want to ignore it. I just hope it's not true. Hope is a strategy. Something's going to happen that'll right it, that'll improve the situation, that'll snap back. No. No.
Because we're in too deep?
Well, not until and unless you fundamentally change the structure of property taxation in Illinois. Okay. Otherwise, and the spend of local governments, which drive your property tax bill, starting with the school districts, because otherwise the math is inexorable. It will not be stopped, no matter how much you ignore it, because, you know, when you ignore problems, they go away. No matter how much you mau-mau it, who you want to listen to that have rosy scenarios about how this is all going to somehow work out, there's magical thinking, no. Which brings us to our latest regional update on home sales and property taxes. DuPage County.
Your neck of the woods, where we were yesterday, Joe Cotton Ford.
Correct.
At Carroll Stream at Gary and North End.
Speaking of Carroll Stream. Yeah. By the way, because it's DuPage County, I've got a fun one for you, although okay. Not fun for this family.
Wait, is it your family home?
No.
Oh.
Another superstar from DuPage County.
Who?
Billy Corgan.
Oh. He lives in DuPage County now?
He doesn't live there. He grew up in Glendale Heights.
Oh, that's right.
Billy Corgan's family home in Glendale Heights. We'll talk about that, Smashing Pumpkins frontman, and what's happened to his parents' home. Even if you're a big star like Billy Corgan or me.
Right. Oh, yeah. When I think of Billy Corgan, I think of Dan Frost.
Sure.
How do you know?
Yeah. Big entertainers. Yeah. Big entertainers. The biggest.
Celebrity star.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So you're a big superstar, international superstar like Billy Corgan. You're not insulated. The Corgan family not insulated. Nobody escapes the math. I don't know how many other ways to say it. You think you're getting a steal when you see these homes going for less than
what they're worth?
Well, less than what they were purchased for years earlier. You think you're getting a steal, right? Instead, in point of fact, you're the next one to get robbed. That's what people don't understand. Speaking of Carroll Stream, since we were out with our friend Tracy Kahn and the boys and girls at
Joe Cotton Ford.
Joe Cotton
Ford. Don't play the song.
Yeah, exactly. Just a guy in there.
Maybe you should play the song.
Keep him on a short leash. Two decades ago, 1997, Ron and Laura Delcello, I don't know. Sorry if I'm massacring your name.
I can read the name for you.
Could you?
Yeah.
What is it right there?
Decello.
Oh, massacre and a racial slur.
I wasn't.
Ethnic slur.
Why are you busting my onions?
There you go. Double down. Hey, lean into it.
Do they own an Italian ristorante?
As long as you don't sing Carly Simon, I'm fine. Ron and Laura Decello, that's what I'm going with, bought a 2,000 square foot, three bedroom, three bath home in Carroll Stream's Kingport Ridge subdivision for about $206,000 in 1997, again, 20 years ago. Okay. That's about $324,000 real dollars today, so inflation adjusted. That's how you do math and comparisons. Inflation adjusted $324,000. They sold their home last week, August 20th. For $322,000 is what they sold it for 20 years after they bought it for $324,000. While their home value stayed constant for 20 years, property taxes doubled. In total, the DeCellos paid approximately $145,000 in property taxes during their time in that home over 20 years. So, you know, nearing half the home value over two-thirds of your customary 30-year fixed time span. It's one of 16 DuPage counties, Carroll Stream, whose effective property tax rates are higher than 2.3%, which is already twice the national average. Wayne, 3.5%. Glendale Heights, 3%. Hanover Park, Bartlett, Roselle, Aurora, Woodridge, Oakbrook, Warrenville, Itasca, Winfield, Addison, Oakbrook Terrace, Lombard, Wooddale, and St. Charles. All of those communities have effective property tax rates higher than twice the national average. So had the DeCellos lived in Indiana, their $9,299 annual tax bill before they sold their home last week
would have been how much?
$2,800.
Wow.
Which adds up to a difference of about 90 grand over the time 20 years they own their home. I mean, again, if 90 grand is no big deal to you because you're a rich guy and you hate your money, a rich girl, you hate your money, fine. No problem. Just telling you what the stats are. You can make your own judgment. Increased housing demand, a booming economy, home prices are rising at twice the rate of inflation nationally. Twice the rate of inflation nationally. Not in DuPage County. Not in DuPage County, where high and growing property tax bills mean home equity gains go to local governments, not homeowners. Luxury homeowners in DuPage seeing huge losses. Homeowners in middle-class communities, middle-income communities, running in place at best. Give you the luxury end of it. I mean, try and sell a home for north of 600 grand in DuPage. Try.
Yeah, can't do it.
No, you'll sell a home. You know how you get out of that home? Sell it for 450. That's how you sell it. Hey, but it's a hot market. You know, look at these homes going. Yeah, as long as you're willing to take a drilling, sure. Median home sale price in Oakbrook during the first 6 months of this year, according to actual home sales. So again, it's a sample. But it's indicative of something that's happening. During the first 6 months of the year, the median home sale price in Oakbrook dropped from $579 to $420 year over year. I mean, that is a big number. A six-bedroom, five-bath home in Oakbrook's Brook Forest subdivision sold for $531,000 just a few days ago. Pastor and author Curtis Stennis and his wife Linda paid $845 for it in 2003. $1.157 million in constant dollars. $1.157 sold for $531. How about it? 11,000 square foot mansion at 815 Mary Lane with an indoor heated swimming pool, a retractable roof. Sold for $865,000 6 days ago. Its owners, originally asking $1.44 million, they paid in constant dollars $1.375. $1.375 sold for $865.
Oh, that's a huge loss.
Property taxes more than doubled on that home just since 2012, from $9,500 to more than $20,000. Billy Corrigan's home? His boyhood home?
Childhood home, yep.
His home at 1424 Jill Court.
I don't think you should say that.
It's public record.
Okay.
1,500 square foot bi-level with four bedrooms and two baths. His parents bought the home in 1969.
You were in junior high school then, right?
Yeah, they long ago sold the home, by the way.
Oh, okay.
His parents bought the home in 1969. The median home value was $164,000 today's dollars. The home last sold in 2014 for
$170,000.
$164,000 in 1969. In 2014, $170,000. So in 50 years.
50 years? It only went up.
It went up nothing.
$6,000.
Yeah. But then you have to include the fact that the tax bill is $5,600 a year, at least on the 2014 sale price. That's 3.3% of its home value.
Hey.
So how much they paid for that home, again, in the property taxes they paid over half a century.
Hey.
And you think we've done Lake County. We've done Will County now.
Cook County.
We've done parts of Cook. Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, this is DuPage. I've got Will County here. There is no escape. There's not like, oh, this community is insulated. This neighborhood. This person, because they're so smart. You cannot escape it because you can't escape the local government spend. You can't escape $130 billion in unfunded pension liabilities for which your home is collateral that's being liquidated by the government to underwrite, to stave off, to finance the 54-year-old Maine West High School principal who retires and will make everything back she put into the retirement system in year three, will make more than she was making working by the time she's 65, has a present value pension of $7 million. Your home will be taken unless this changes. Fact. And I don't care if you live in Hinsdale or Oak Brook or Winnetka or Glendale Heights or Wheaton or Mount Prospect. It's the same story. I don't know what it takes to pound this into people's heads and to have them connect the dots to demand something different from their school district and from their state legislators. And obviously state elected officials with respect to changing the way we do property taxation and changing the way we do school funding in this state. Or just, you know, or get out from underneath or just watch your home be taken. It is what is going to happen in Will County. Border, right? Border community, Crete Township. Tire shop owner Frank Elliman and his marketing executive wife Jessica selling their 5-bedroom, 4-bath, 28-square-foot ranch on 5 wooded acres.
Wow.
In a development called Willowbrook in unincorporated Crete Township, abutting the Indiana border. Ask price $324.
That many acreage?
5 acres, 2,800 square feet, 5-bedroom, 4-bath, 324. Okay. 2 miles, 5-minute drive east over the state line, 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch in a nondescript subdivision, a home 1/3 smaller on 1/15th of the lot size can be had for the same price, $325.
Hmm.
Right? Because a small home on a size 1/15th a lot is worth $325 because of property taxes. This expansive lot with 5 bedrooms and 4 baths, twice the size three times the size of the home in Dyer, is only $324 because property taxes. The buyer in that of that Dyer home I'm describing, $238 a month in property taxes. In Crete, $944. The Crete homeowner, same home value, and I've given you the descriptions on the respective homes, the Crete homeowner will pay $254,000 more than the Dyer, Indiana homeowner over the course of a 30-year fixed mortgage.
It's a no-brainer. If you're that close to Indiana, live in Indiana.
Amy in Huntley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, you know, you're a really smart guy. I've been listening to you for a while. There's got to be a solution to this. And
yeah.
I listened to you. I've been in the car for about 15, 20 minutes, and you've been going on and on about this. And I feel like slitting my wrist. I mean, it's really depressing. You need to come up with some sort of a solution.
We have a solution. We have a solution.
Hey, that'll work.
We have a solution. We've been talking about it ad nauseum. I have been for, I don't know, the last 2 years, particularly the last year. Do the same thing Indiana does. The solution.
Okay.
It's you know, and I appreciate that. Thanks for prompting me on that, Amy. 1% hard cap on
property taxes
as a percentage of home value. That's what Indiana does. So with the Dyer Crete example, that's the difference. And Indiana has schools, and they have police departments, and they have fire departments. It's all true. You can check it out. They've got a state government. They've got the whole thing. And every other state in the nation, including states with no income tax, like Florida, that still have lower property taxes than Illinois. You cannot make a case for this property tax system. Unless you are an opponent of home ownership or return on investment, then you can, I suppose. 1% hard cap. It also has the daisy chain effect of handcuffing local units of government with respect to their spend, which is key. And it will force a discussion on defined benefit pension plans that are not financeable under the current structure. And it's funny, I got this call yesterday, voicemail, from this veteran who said, oh, you know, Dan, thanks, you know, you and John Cass and Rauner and Janice and the Republican Party, thanks so much for being so anti-union and showing us who you are and this and that. I mean, are you serious? Yeah, it's like, oh, all the veterans out there want you to know. Like, this is the spokesman for veterans. That veteran will be interested to know that you've already had, you're tracking right now to have 8% of the public sector unionized workforce drop out of their public sector unions per Janus. I bet there's some veterans in there. NEA at the national level is looking at a 14% decline in membership. The math is the math is the math. I don't care if you're a veteran or not a veteran. It's all specious, workers of the world unite, pablum. And that coward who called in, and yes, he's a coward because he didn't leave his name or his number. Could I call? I'd call him and have him on the show. And if he's listening like he was yesterday, then call in, tough guy. And let's have a discussion on the merits rather than your bull jive talking points from the latest union hall you were sitting around swilling beer in. It's a joke. You may not care about your life savings and your property being liquidated. You may not care. You may be fine electing the same suburban Democrats that tell you the same lies about their support for phony baloney property tax freezes, because that's what's happening right now. You get it in your mailbox all the time. You may believe it. Fine. Free country, coalition of willing, do what you want. But I'm not going to. And a lot of other people aren't either. And those people are going to leave, and then you're going to be left holding the bag. And when you go to try and sell your home and you take a bath, who are you going to complain to? Bill on the north side.
You know, I don't know how many Chicagoans know that the alderman is a part-time job. They will do it with 40 seats. Why do we need 50? Can the alderman down 24 in numbers?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bill. You're breaking up.
Well, they make six figures. They can have a driver if they want. They have access to TIF funds or deciding who gets TIF funds. They have way too much power in this town, I think.
Yeah, but and it's fine. You can eliminate the city council. I mean, I agree. Start with the politicians. Eliminate the pensions. Eliminate the health care benefits for all the state legislators, for the aldermen. Their salaries should be no more than the median household income in this state. There should actually be less because, as you point out, it's a part-time job. And that's a drop in the bucket. You have to do something structural, structural across the board, not for just one cohort of people. It's too big. It's too far gone.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss David Clark and James O'Keefe at Freedom Summit 2018. Get your tickets today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and you know, what a fall from grace for a paragon of integrity like Lanny Davis.
No,
I don't know how to tell you. What's the, let's go to the tote board first, though. What's the latest on Michael Cohen versus Peter Strzok? We're following that GoFundMe race.
Peter Strzok has $461,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His goal is $500,000. Michael Cohen also has $500,000 as a goal. And he's up past 150,000 so far.
All right, but Michael Cohen just started.
He did just start it. Yeah, Strzok had a few weeks, ahead of him. But they're both vying for $500,000.
Please don't make them go full Sally Struthers.
Yeah, we don't want to see any PSA type commercials on.
Oh, open your hearts and open your wallets for these
two goofballs.
Two gentlemen felled by tragedy, according to Lanny Davis. One had bank fraud committed upon him.
It's like a disease, a virus that kind of sneaks up on you, bank fraud.
Well, these applications fill themselves out, and sometimes they overstate or understate, forget to state debt load, for example, that may factor into a line of credit. That's just for example. And obviously, Peter Strzok only terminated, otherwise persecuted, because he sent nasty tweets about Trump to his paramour, mistress. That's according to the New York Times, I recall. So, again, these tragic figures. Now Lanny Davis, representing Michael Cohen, might be counted among them because, boy, unfortunately, and this is surprising coming from somebody who made his bones with the Clinton team.
Right, that's right. He was a Clinton's attorney,
White House counselor. I mean, synonymous with honesty.
Right.
Team Clinton.
And he kind of stepped in it and got caught. Not kind of, he did step in it.
Yeah, he had to retract a couple of things that he's previously said while he was beating his chest about Michael Cohen last week. This in an interview with the Washington Post, I should have been more clear, including with you. I could not independently confirm what happened, meaning that Michael Cohen did not witness President Trump being told about the meeting with Don Jr. et al. And the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower before it happened. He can't confirm that that did happen, even though he said it did. Michael Cohen had knowledge. He also said Michael Cohen had knowledge that Special Counsel Mueller would be very interested in about things like Trump's pre-knowledge of the hacking of the DNC by the Russians. And no, I'm not sure. Now, Landy Davis says possibly that's the case, but I'm not sure. Well, sure, anything's possible.
I hate when the facts get in the way of a good story. Or when the truth gets in the way, too.
So does Lanny Davis. So you have that in common with him. For more on this topic and how anti-Trump hyperbole coming from Lanny Davis and the D.C. press corps is driving people insane, we're pleased to be joined by Roger Kimball, editor of the New Criterion, columnist for PJ Media. You can also regularly read his stuff at amgreatness.com. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Are you crestfallen over the fall from grace for one Lanny Davis?
Yes, I have my black armband on now. And,
did you like it?
Writing people notes with black bordered stationery. It's truly sad.
Does it surprise you that he blew the CNN exclusive interview?
No. I mean, you know, frankly, it's hard. It's hard to work up much surprise these days. I really do think that President Trump has gotten under the skins of his opponents to such an extent that he really has driven them crazy. I mean, when you have someone of the stature of Elliot Cohen, a smart man, comparing the president to Macbeth, a regicide, someone who murdered his rival's families, who was a power-hungry tyrant. He really was a tyrant. Now, what has this president done that's so tyrannous? Well, he's rescued the economy from the doldrums, bequeathed him by Barack Obama. He's made scores of terrific judicial appointments. He's rolled back the regulatory state. He's bolstered the American military. He has, enhanced America's standing in the international scene. It's just been one triumph after the next. And for every triumph that he wins, it seems to drive his opponents crazier and crazier. It's quite extraordinary. If you just go down the list, go to some news aggregator like Real Clear Politics, and they're very even-handed. So they'll have, some pieces supporting the president and then many attacking him. But the headlines are things like, Donald Trump is a criminal. It's on the basis of what? It's pure fantasy. In that column you mentioned, I talk about a line from Plato's Republic where he says, a lot of people will lie. That's not surprising. But no one would want what Plato calls the lie in the soul, which means that you are so dishonest that you're dishonest to yourself and you can no longer distinguish effectively between the truth and a lie, between reality and some distortion of reality. And I'm afraid that that's what has happened to many of the president's opponents. It's not that they disagree with him. They fundamentally believe that he is illegitimate. Therefore, he's like a heretic. He can't be argued with. He has to be destroyed. And it's poisonous. It's poisonous for our country, and I hope it will end soon.
That's a perfect segue to Adam Schiff, who fits that description, in my estimation. Although, here's the one thing that can shake them back to reality, poll numbers. And it was interesting that Adam Schiff was on with Jake Tapper over the weekend, pulling the reins on impeachment, now suggesting after all kinds of pronouncements about evidence of collusion that would be forthcoming, and to your point, suggesting that this is an illegitimate person and thus an illegitimate president. Now Adam Schiff talking about, whoa, as a former federal prosecutor, I like to gather all the evidence before I make a determination. So it's much too early to be talking about impeachment. This on the heels of Nancy Pelosi saying after Cohen's plea that impeachment is not a priority. It seems that Democrats are getting attuned to the public mood, at least with respect to making this election a referendum on impeachment.
Yes. Well, I think that the investigation is a referendum on impeachment. I you know, have become, you know, gradually convinced that the Mueller investigation has nothing to do with investigating possible ties between the Trump administration and Russian meddling in the election. It's nothing to do with that, and everything to do with impeachment. But I think that probably what you're seeing with Mr. Schiff is you're right, poll numbers, but also look at the mood of the country. I think the economy is booming, and people were talking a few months ago about a blue wave that was going to wash the Republicans out of Congress, probably the Senate, and definitely the House of Representatives. Well, I think that most dispassionate observers now realize that the Republicans are very likely indeed to pick up seats in the Senate, and that they will hold the House and maybe even pick up some seats in the House. But so that being the case, impeachment is a dead letter. I just think that there's a kind of political reality that Adam Schiff is reluctantly bending to.
When do you think this craziness is going to end, this Mueller investigation?
Well, you know, I thought it would have ended a long time ago. I predicted, you know, at the extraordinary reaction to the president's inaugural address, which I thought was terrific, but it was greeted as if it were, you know, a speech by Adolf Hitler or something. I thought, yes, okay, we'll have this for a little while, but then it will calm down because people will say, well, he's not really Hitler. He's actually, you know, he's actually pretty competent, but we don't like what he's doing. But, you know, then it would just kind of go back to normal partisan bickering. But that hasn't happened. And I can't quite explain it. I could understand it if he were doing a bad job, but I cannot think, there's been no president in my lifetime not even Ronald Reagan, who's had the kinds of success this president has had in the first 2 years. It's been absolutely extraordinary. And I don't know, maybe that reality just pushes them further over the edge. I don't know. But let's say that the midterms go well for the Republicans. Maybe that would be a kind of wake-up call to the Democrats, and they'll start calling off the Antifa thugs and dial back the senile gibbering of Nancy Pelosi and the insane socialistic maunderings of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. I mean, these people... in a sane world, they would deserve our pity and compassion because they're clearly out of touch with reality. But unfortunately, being in positions of power, they also require our vigilance because they're dangerous people. It's an extraordinary situation to find ourselves in.
With respect to the Mueller investigation, in a sort of counterintuitive way, is the extension of it something that ultimately benefits Trump? I mean, if there's nothing to hide, assuming there's nothing more in terms of wrongdoing other than these hush money payments, because now you've got Bruce Orr on the Hill today. So it one key player from Justice or FBI, CIA at some point, like Brennan, who's been just, you know, testifying on cable news shows mainly, where he doesn't get indicted if he commits perjury. But you see one after the other of these high-ranking officials, and they get completely taken apart on the merits of what they did versus what they said and what they did versus what we think they should be doing. And all of that, unfortunately, the reckoning may need to come, undermines the credibility of the agencies and these individuals, but it essentially delegitimizes the investigation and redounds to the benefit of Trump.
Well, I think ultimately that may be right, but the problem is that the prosecutorial machine over which Robert Mueller is presiding is extraordinarily powerful and extraordinarily damaging. I mean, he has destroyed many people's lives already who have nothing to do with any Russian collusion. It's just a kind of grinding machine that is, seems to have unlimited funds. He has a stable full of rabid Democratic Obama and Hillary supporting prosecutors, people who have destroyed companies like this guy Weissman, who he destroyed a huge accounting firm. Then it turned out that he was wrong. But meanwhile, 17,000 people or something were out of work. These people are it's unfortunately the Justice Department in this country has become part of this deep state, and they all this tradition now of plea bargaining, which means you kind of admit guilt for things you didn't do. And, Michael Flynn, what has he been indicted for? Well, a kind of process crime. It's more process than crime, as I put it. He was entrapped by the FBI, essentially. And there's been a lot of collateral damage. There's likely to be more. And if you keep digging and digging and digging, what is Paul Manafort on the hook for? Yes, tax evasion. You oughtn't to have done that, but that was like in 2005.
Yeah.
Right. He was pretty good at it. I mean,
apparently. And we may learn more in his second trial, but even to your point, here's another trial about more crimes related to his business dealings. He is Roger Kimball, editor at the New Criterion, columnist for PJ Media. Check out his latest piece, How Anti-Trump Hyperbole Fosters Insanity. Roger, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Terrific. Talk to you soon, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods taken to task for not succumbing to the temptation to take on Trump.
Oh, yeah. He was confronted after he. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was confronted at the PGA. What, Sunday after he played 72 holes? The man was hungry. Man's got to eat. But while he was, leaving the course, they asked him questions about his relationship with Trump.
And
do you want to play the reporter or do you want to play Tiger?
This was this past Sunday.
Yeah.
After the Northern Trust.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know the title sponsor
keep
of the tournament.
Your tour events.
Hey, by the way, ancillary issue. Have you found a sponsor yet for your game?
Not the way I'm playing. Are you kidding me?
Is it really gotten that bad?
No.
Or you just, is this all hyperbole?
No, it's terrible. I've hit like three clean iron shots in the last 3 weeks.
Is it mental now?
I mean,
is
I don't,
there something psychological going on with your golf game?
I don't want to, cause a lot of heartache in the listening audience. I don't want people
let's talk about it.
To, weep for me. Don't cry for me, Argentina. No. It's whatever.
Okay.
Problems. I suck.
So he was walking off the course and he was asked by a sports writer, hey, your relationship with Donald Trump, how would you describe that personally and professionally? Do you want to play Tiger Woods? What his response is? Well, I've known Donald for a number of years. We've played golf together. We've had dinner together. And so, yeah, I've known him pre-presidency and obviously during his presidency.
Doesn't sound anything like Tiger.
Well, the New York... Not even close. Do you want to... role of Tiger.
No, I can't do.
The New York Times reporter followed up, well, at a time, especially in 2018, I think a lot of people, especially people of color, immigrants, feel threatened by him, by his policy. He's thrown himself in sports debates in terms of race with NBA player LeBron James, with the national anthem. What do you say to people who might find it interesting, I guess, that you have a friendly relationship with him? And Wood's answer?
Not too much baiting there, right?
Oh, no, no. Well, he's the president of the United States, and you have to respect the office. And no matter who's in the office, you may like, dislike the personality or the politics, but we all must respect the office. I mean, honestly.
And he's hungry, and I want to go get something
to eat.
Well,
then he tried yet again. Well, do you have anything to say more broadly about the state, I guess, the discourse of race relations? No, Tiger Woods said with a slight smile, I just finished 72 holes and I'm really hungry. And if you don't get out of my way, I'm going to be hangry.
Yeah, I think he needs to get back on the HGH. His voice is a lot higher than I remember it.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah, that's better. that has drawn a response from none other than Max Kellerman. I know what you're saying, especially if you're not a boxing fan. Who's Max Kellerman?
Who's Max Kellerman?
He's like white male Jemele Hill.
Oh,
who's
okay.
Now gone at ESPN to pursue politics. Well, Kellerman actually tried to cut his teeth in a little bit of politics too. He was on CNN before, and he was like a contributor to Tucker Carlson's show when Tucker Carlson had a show on MSNBC. He's a really good boxing announcer, but when he talks politics, and he's done it on a number of occasions on these insufferable roundtable chat shows on ESPN.
Oh, I know. They're unwatchable.
I mean, it's where you just have, especially when they get off sports, you just have people competing to see who knows less. And that's what Stephen Smith and Max Kellerman did in this exchange, where actually Stephen Smith was the reasonable position and Max Kellerman took out after Tiger, suggesting that his response is unacceptable.
And I just want to say something because I know it came from a good place when you said that I'm informed, but I don't have an I have an ideological tilt, in fact, but I keep that off the air. For example,
the great John McCain
passed. Ideologically, I disagreed with him fundamentally about many things, but he was a great man and a great American. And had he won the general election, whether or not I voted for him, I would have been proud to call him the president of the United States, my president.
Okay.
Ideology has nothing to do with my commentary on Trump, especially as it relates to sports.
Here comes
nothing
ideology.
To do with it. In fact, I know some people don't believe that. That is the truth. We're talking about someone under multiple federal investigations.
Yep.
About possible conspiracy with a hostile foreign power to fix a U.S. election. His close associates, several of them, have already been convicted or have pled guilty. He's essentially, at this point, a co-conspirator. To multiple felonies to which his lawyer has confessed. I mean, we're not talking about a normal situation here. So when Tiger Woods...
That's a subject for another day because...
Except that we are talking about the current office holder.
Yeah, but
I want to say something about what Tiger Woods said.
Okay,
now.
Go ahead.
It really bothers me. I am angry at what Tiger Woods said because it is a thoughtless statement dressed up as a thoughtful statement. And it either holds in contempt the intelligence of the people who hear it or else it's just a stupid thing to say. Let me tell you what I mean. If to say that the office, you must have respect for the office. Tiger, be clear. Are you saying that the office therefore confers respect onto its occupant? Its present temporary occupant?
My goodness.
No. Having respect for the office means, principally, in my view, is the office holder should have respect for the office.
Well,
we are all set to a standard. We're held to a standard of behavior. We at our jobs, right? People in their daily lives. The president, if anything, is held to a higher standard of behavior. It is not such that we have such great respect for the office that no matter what the behavior of its occupant, we must therefore respect its occupant because of the office. No, Tiger Woods is being slick. Here he's being slick. We must respect the office. Therefore, that confers respect to the occupant. Tiger, is that what you're saying? If that's what you're saying, that is a stupid comment.
Speaking of stupid comments, this is the same Max Kellerman who admitted to slapping his wife on the air Yeah. Now, they've been happily married for 20 years, I hasten to add, to be fair, something Max Kellerman wouldn't be. But he admitted to slapping her. He was suspended for those comments on the air. I'm not saying that Max Kellerman is somebody that should be held to a standard of saying the leader of the free world, because obviously he couldn't abide that standard. But it does tell you something about the sports press corps, which we talk about intermittently in the context of the media generally, and how most of these men and women are men and women of the left, and they so desire to be taken seriously that they fold in with the political press corps, which is mostly men and women of the left, and sing the same tune that they're singing.
But does Max Kellerman know history? I mean, Tiger Woods has played golf with Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, Barack Obama. I mean,
The idea of dissecting Tiger Woods's effort to just get out of the conversation, essentially, it was a gracious way for Tiger to get out of it without saying, look, I'm not going to take your bait. Just leave me the frack alone. He could have gone that route. Instead, he just said, you know, made an overture to respecting the office and just basically said, look, I don't want to get involved in politics.
Right.
Tiger, for the most part, I can't recall where he has been particularly partisan or political. He wants to stay away from that.
It's smart.
Well, it's smart, and it's also demonstrates some restraint. Tiger hasn't always demonstrated restraint in all aspects of his life, but here he has. And, that's a little bit of an evidence, perhaps, of humility, something that Max Kellerman certainly doesn't possess.
President Trump took to Twitter, said the fake news media worked hard to get Tiger Woods to say something he didn't want to say. Tiger wouldn't play the game. He is very smart. More importantly, he's playing great golf again.
Yeah.
Which is true.
A friend of mine knows Max Kellerman. He just texted me. Kellerman's a little weasel, and he's also anti-Christian. Well, that comes as no surprise. This is a rabid man of the left. He's losing his mind over Tiger's unwillingness to pile on and offer some cheap, like Kathy Griffin, Jemele Hill, Max Kellerman commentary on Trump. Of course he's a little weasel. Phil in Deerfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. This always wondered me in the Clinton era, too. Why do you hold a president to a higher standard than you hold yourself to? I've never understood this. You need to hold yourself to your standard. And don't expect more out of somebody else that you don't expect out of yourself.
Okay. All right. I take that point. Thanks for the call, Phil. I mean, you know, the idea that you're the leader of the free world and people, you know, hang on your every word, and every word and pronouncement gets dissected. So there is that standard. But I think that's fair. I mean, you know, think about this generally. Do you try to hold yourself to a higher standard than you see politicians holding themselves? Generally speaking,
yeah.
Trump included, but generally speaking. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think it's fair. Because the whole, like, holding to a higher standard, respect the office, but holding to a higher standard, it doesn't go all the way down the road, but it gets you started down this road of people in office, even the president of the United States, are our betters. They are not our betters. They are temporary representatives. That's all they are. Temporary, some not temporary enough, temporary representatives. Their means to policy ends, that's all they are. Stop falling in love with them, Trump included. James in Westmont.
Morning. It was good to see you two lovely people yesterday, Ed, by the way.
Yeah. Did you ever go to work, or you just hang around Joe Cotton Ford all day?
Well, you know, I worked down the street, actually. So
okay.
I wasn't too far from there.
All right,
yeah, it was, actually.
All right,
so
just checking
you.
On you. Yeah.
Actually, during Max Kellerman's nonsensical drivel, it was funny to hear him try to keep that broadcast voice up. I don't know if he knows he struggled quite a bit. And he was just like, you sounded like Mike, the guy after you. I'm sorry, I forgot his name.
the Gallagher.
Mike Gallagher. You sound like Mike Gallagher struggling.
All right. Okay. Thanks for the call, James. Yeah, I mean,
no,
well, Kellerman, you know, he had to kind of whip up the moral indignation, right? And you could hear him getting more and more. Yeah. Mark in Des Plaines.
Good morning, you guys. Amy, it's so refreshing to have you back.
Well, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean that sincerely. But, you know, I'll tell you, this is a very good point that we're on right now in this discussion. We should never venerate human beings as if they were deity. They are not. They are fallible. We are all fallible. We should, you know, hope that they'll set a good example. And you know, Trump's former life, it really wasn't that great of an example, but what he's doing in office, what he's actually doing, is right and correct, and for the entrepreneur, and for the common man, and the common good, okay? So that's really significant. Let's not set these people up on pedestals. And that goes for the Pope and anyone else.
All right, thanks for the call, Mark. I mean, with some exceptions, right? Your Pete Maraviches, your Michael Jordans.
Yeah.
I mean, these are deities. These were gods on earth. Small g, of course.
I want you to kill every golfer on the course.
Check me if I'm wrong, Sandy, but if I kill all the golfers, they're going to lock me up and throw away the key.
Golfers! You great kid, not golfers. The little brown furry rodents.
We can do that.
Why?
We don't even have to have a reason.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, make sure you get your tickets to join us for Freedom Summit 2018. It's coming on Saturday, October 27th at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. It's an all-day event. And this year's keynote speakers include former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark and James O'Keefe from Project Veritas. Our very own Mike Gallagher will also be there, and we will be there as well. Tickets are selling fast, so make sure you get yours at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com. This event always sells out, so get your tickets today. And thanks to our sponsors, Precision Payroll of America, Tom Sadek over there, Automated System Incorporated, Joe Cotton Ford, Charles Energy Equipment Systems, Tom Mirabali, independent agent for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, Chicagoland Waterproofing, and healthinsurancementors.com.
And I wanted to just say a thank you to the Eisenhower Center. I'm not familiar with this, but they sent us a bunch of dog treats.
And we split them equally, by the way.
Right. I'm going to eat mine. You're going to give yours to Bunky.
Exactly. Actually, they smell so good, I want to eat them. Is that bad?
That's my dog. Probably upsetting the neighbors.
Yeah, because somebody's walking treats to the elevator.
He does listen to the show, Hayek.
That's good. You know what? That's probably soothing for him if you put the AM560 on.
He critiques me when I get home because I'm insane and I hear him talking to me. The Eisenhower Center is actually in up in Milwaukee. Eisenhower Center partnering with businesses, manufacturers in Milwaukee to provide vocational training and jobs for people with disabilities. And so they've got profiles on the people who make these dog treats that they then sell, and this is great. I'm a part of a nonprofit. I'm the board of a nonprofit that serves people with disabilities and tries to fully integrate them as much as possible in the community, including getting jobs. Seguin Services out in Cicero does the same thing. There's so many good organizations, and they sent us a great concept, though, for people with disabilities, so they're involved in like the packaging
and they put the pictures together of everyone. So this says meet Phyllis, focused, driven to succeed. So you see the person who actually made the dog treats.
Yeah, they make the dog treats too.
They put their pictures on the package, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, Ike Bites.
Kudos to them.
Ike Bites dog treats is what they're called. Nice marketing campaign too.
Ike Bites, I love it.
So I can't wait to split these with Hayek when I get home.
Baked from scratch, no additives or preservatives, so we can eat them if we get hungry.
IkeBitesDogTreats.com, and it's great. And then you can meet some of the people that have done this, have put together this whole product, and send it off to us, which we appreciate. And again, it's a little tip for you out there. If you want your product mentioned, you just have to give us free samples.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Weather not cooperating with the forecast. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be 93 degrees
and
it's 72 right now.
And the rain's not going to come till 9 tonight, except it's here and it's been here.
And it's not even 9 a.m., so a little off today. But, great, we're going to get almost 3 inches of rain. Great.
Okay, Skilling. Yeah, whatever.
My basement floods.
All right. All right, so John McCain, a bit of damage control and...
rightfully so, don't you think?
I mean, yeah, I mean, President Trump yesterday lowering the flag at the White House to half staff.
Finally, but other places around D.C. had already lowered the flag to half staff. They just did it on their own out of respect for John McCain.
And the flag at the golf course I played at was at half staff.
That's nice. Yeah. Good.
Despite our differences, and Mistwood, by the way, I should give them credit, I suppose. Despite our differences on policy and politics, I respect Senator John McCain's service to our country, Trump said in an official statement, building upon what had been said the day previous.
Finally, it took him long enough. The reporters were all over him.
Mr. President, any thoughts on John McCain, sir?
He just sat there stone-faced. I didn't say a word until later. But, you know, I mean, they didn't like each other. They were political rivals. Yes, they were both in the same party, but they didn't, you know, he didn't like him. He was a different kind of Republican. They've always had a, you know, adversarial type of relationship. And so Trump was too true to himself and didn't cave to pressure. But then eventually he did.
That's
because, you know, even there was a meeting with evangelicals last night, yeah. And everyone, you know, John Kelly suggested let's lower the flag. So did Sarah Sanders, and he finally did it.
Russ Feingold is going to be at the service.
Oh, who are the pallbearers again?
Pallbearers to include Warren Beatty.
Because he's so vain.
Joe Biden.
Oh.
You had a
is
moment.
Is he so tall?
Gary Hart.
Gary Hart? Didn't he die?
Can you imagine? I mean,
Gary Hart, Warren Beatty, and Joe, how are they going to be able to carry the casket? I'm not being rude, but I'm just saying logistically, they're old beefcakes.
I mean, you walk along it probably.
Right. Oh,
I mean,
okay.
It's not like a lot of heavy lifting involved. They're not like parading it down Pennsylvania Avenue.
But some churches have stairs where you have to carry it up the stairs. All right, I'm sure that won't happen.
Yeah.
I'll
tell you what, you give Cindy a call and you figure out the logistics and then report back to us.
Warren Beatty, Gary Hart, Joe Biden, I can't wait to see the starting lineup.
Gary Hart. Oh. How about Gary Hart? I mean, imagine... What derailed Gary Hart's campaign, the presidential ambitions in 1984, as compared to what the standard is today?
I'm going to take a little look, see what Gary Hart looks like today.
Gary Hart, and then also FedEx CEO Fred Smith, among others who will be in attendance, including executives from pharmaceutical companies. And I don't know if is Charles Keating, is he available? Oh, is that too soon? Yeah, I know. What about the other members of the Keating Five? Are they available, or is that too soon?
Too soon.
I'm just saying, you know, separating again McCain's military service from his record as a politician. I think the two can be separated and should. And the latter is certainly a legitimate topic for discussion as he's being lionized. Michael Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg. What, is going to be a pallbearer?
No, Michael Bloomberg will be in attendance. Oh, you know, all the post-partisan types. You know, people who are not partisan, like Joe Biden. People who are post-partisan, like Barack Obama. Yeah, Russ Feingold. Non-partisan people. Post-partisan people. Yeah, okay. I mean, I appreciate, again... McCain's service, but I think those in attendance speak to sort of the combine culture, if I can borrow a John Cassism, that existed in D.C. prior to Trump and still does, of course. It doesn't change. The culture doesn't change that fast. And by the way, Trump was a part of it. I mean, Trump gave money to candidates on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
So now he's this disruptive figure, and there's a lot of good in that. And it's interesting, Peter Thiel, you know, the Silicon Valley billionaire investor who left Silicon Valley because he just can't tolerate the groupthink anymore, the poison, the intellectual poisonous environment that it is, intellectually poisonous environment. He said at a Monday event in Sao Paulo, Brazil, I got to meet a lot of the people running for president on the U.S. Republican side in 2016, and they all felt like zombies. They couldn't say anything different than other than programmed ideological sound bites. Trump, Thiel said, is very healthy, corrective to that. I fully understand why people think of President Trump as a rude, mean person, but I think that's often better than telling beautiful lies about the way the country is working. I think that's a really interesting topic area that transcends McCain and all of this rigmarole. The idea of, because we have succumbed to it in Illinois for generations now, the beautiful lies rather than the mean truth. Truth is mean. Because the truth, like the math, doesn't care about your feelings. But we don't like mean, and we don't like math, so we're content with beautiful lies. What about that? The beautiful lies over the mean truth. Which do you prefer? I know everybody will say, of course, the mean truth, but that's not how you behave. Maybe not in our listening audience generally, but that's not how a lot of your friends and family and those in your social circle behave. Beautiful lies or the mean truth? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I think Teal is on to something. I don't agree with him on a lot of things because he's a different kind of guy. But, just in terms of like wanting to live forever and, you know, being an atheist and so forth. But he's an insightful and innovative thinker. And I would encourage you to read his book, Zero to One, by the way, if you haven't. But I think he's really onto something here.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Beautiful lies or the mean truth, Amy? What's it going to be?
I think it's beautiful lies.
Yeah, okay, there you go. I appreciate
that. That's the name of my junior high
truth.
Band.
I appreciate
yes.
it, yeah.
Beautiful lies.
That was a Glass Tiger cover band, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Chip in St. Charles.
The beautiful truth. Hey, I just wanted to say that it seems like all the people are going to be showing up to haul his casket and be in his funeral are John McCain's peers, which is the Washington swamp, and that's a big part of what he was.
Well, he was a bipartisan champion. That's what they, you know.
Thanks to the call, Chip.
He was okay with that. He was okay being the maverick.
Well, is it
different?
Is
going against the grain, rocking the boat.
Is whatever. It really different, though? The whole point is that the combine, like being a part of the combine is not being different, it's being the same. So you can apply the maverick label all you want. What's the work product? Russ throwing in with the other side is being a maverick? Or it's being more of the same? McCain-Feingold, what's the substance of the work product? Good? McCain-Feingold? Voting against Obamacare repeal and replace?
Oh, that's awful.
Huh. Being a maverick.
I saw that coming.
Being disruptive to what ends? I mean, that's why I say Trump is disruptive in many respects good, not all. Not all. So we also, the beautiful lie, we sort of take a attitude and that absolves us of the responsibility to examine the work product the attitude generates. Connect the attitude or the input, if you will, to the output. Why don't we do that? I guess because we like the beautiful lie. Yeah, I like that guy. I like the cut of his jib. He's nice, or he's a ball buster, or whatever, however you want to describe him. And then that's the end of the analysis. To what ends? Mike in New Lenox.
Hi, guys. Three of the six pallbearers are Democrats. Is there more? If that doesn't just tell us exactly where John was politically. I mean, I had a hard time, like, having really dislike for the guy when he was alive. But he just drove us crazy politically. And he's a maverick because he kept poking his eye in the conservatives. He grabbed the mantle of Reaganism. When he ran for president, but he wasn't really conservative. That's why he was a maverick. And that's why Washington loves him is that he'd poke his finger in the eye of conservatives. By the way, beautiful lies is what people want. It's what they vote for. You watch it even with CEOs and the way executives talk. We don't really want our politicians to tell us the truth. Otherwise, we'd vote a lot differently.
Thanks for the call,
yesterday,
Mike.
Yesterday, we talked about President Trump not attending his funeral. President Trump wasn't invited to his funeral.
Right, so he's abiding his wishes. Fine.
Right.
No problem.
That's probably some of caused some of the bad blood too.
Yeah, you know. You know? Well, I mean, you know, to say somebody,
and then yesterday he spoke from the grave. You know, sending a message to President Trump through his campaign manager.
Fine.
You remember Mr. Davis?
Rick Davis. Yeah.
We weaken our greatness when we confuse our patriotism with tribal rivalries. We weaken it when we hide behind walls rather than tear them down.
That's a direct message to President Trump.
Yeah, that's a lame one. I mean, that is pro forma beltway speak.
It's the letter he wrote.
It's not even compelling writing. It's anodyne. It's boring. By the way, Cindy McCain, his widow.
Yeah, she wants to take her husband's spot.
Right, because
so the governor of Arizona, with Ducey, is going to have to decide. He did say, though, just in case you're wondering, he's not going to pull a Blago here. He said he's not going to appoint himself to the Senate seat.
Because very much in combine fashion, swamp fashion, if you will, the seat that somebody occupies temporarily becomes their family's possession to bequeath to whomever they see fit.
There'll be a special election in 2020, but
is that being a maverick? Is that being anti-ruling class? Or is that being part of the ruling class?
We'll see what happens in the primaries today. If Martha McSally doesn't win the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate seat, I think she would appoint her.
She's going to win. But so what? That's not the question. The question is the desire. Is that being part of the ruling class? Or is that being a maverick?
What Missouri senator died in his
life? Carnahan.
Carnahan, yeah.
Part of the ruling class or maverick? Mike in Uptown.
Yeah. Since when did you people start praising Vietnam veterans? Now John McCain's dead, so he's a big hero. For 50 years, all you people been doing is savaging Vietnam veterans.
Who's you people? Who's you people?
That's all you say about Vietnam.
Who is you
the
people?
Whole media.
Who is you people, Mike?
Vietnam soldiers for 50 years.
Yeah, well, you're wrong,
now
Mike.
Old. Mike, he's a big hero.
Mike,
he's a big
Mike,
hero.
Mike, you're wrong. You're on the wrong station. Go find any other station, Mike. You clown.
Is he the one that left you the voicemail?
Probably. Open up your ears, dingbat. Well, nothing.
Well, if he served, I thank him for his service. But yes, I think he might be listening to the wrong station.
And here's the point.
Ridicule Vietnam veterans.
Never happened.
We respect John McCain for his service.
How many times do you have to say it on this show? For people open up their ears. I'm not going to tolerate it. I'm not going to tolerate slander when the evidence is so overwhelming. Here's the thing about service to the country, and this goes for John McCain. It's a perfect segue. Your military service, his military service, is beyond reproach, and thankful for it and respect it. That is not does not immunize you from everything else you do in your life. So spare me the moralizing, especially when it's misdirected. Tom in Deer Park.
Well, on a lighter note, John McCain has invited people from the left, the right, overseas, and Hollywood moguls and elite. It's the ultimate troll from the grave because he's invited everybody but the one person. So, Dan, I'm wondering, now that this is playing out, this is McCain's troll this week. How will Trump play it, and will he outdo McCain in some fashion?
Well, he's going to have like a competing event to woo Hollywood celebrities over to his event and not John McCain's funeral? I mean, what are you talking about? He's going to lie in state to the people are going to do what they do, and they're going to show pay their respects, and that'll be it. The president's not going to say anything about it. Other than what he said.
This is a new era we live in, so I have to think in new terms, and that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, this is where, you know, sort of the, what does Brett Baer call it? The Trump derangement syndrome?
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.